welcome to this brand new episode of the Silmarillion Film Project. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale, coming to you live on an extremely hot evening in Pasadena, California. And we have a really exciting episode tonight. We had a brief detour over the last few into creative stuff. Now we're doing battles because that's what everyone's here
for.
That's
how we roll.
That's right. We're getting into action here today.
That's what Tolkien's
conversation.
Tolkien's really fundamentally a story about action.
Combat scenes. That's really the heart of Tolkien's literature right there. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Tactics.
military
descriptions of troop movements.
Absolutely. Right. Nothing he loves better than that.
And thrilling action scenes. So, as you can hear, I am joined, as always, by my wonderful hosts, Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor, and Trish Lambert, the Tolkien maven. How are y'all this evening?
Excellent.
I don't even want to tell you how cool it is in Texas right now. We're having a cold spell.
Ooh.
It's awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very pleasant in New 90s. England today, too.
Yeah, so sorry, Dave. It's, hot potato. You got the hot potato.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, I think Demi's got the really hot potato up there, but
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, up in Alaska.
So, let's do this thing.
Okay, so before we start, just a couple quick announcements. The primary thing for our announcements today is we are getting towards regional moot season again in the Signum calendar. So we kind of mostly take the summer off of our regional moots, but fall and winter and spring are exciting regional moot periods. So we have 8 regional moots planned or tentatively planned this year, and the first two of them are coming up in the fall. The first one is Minute Moot in Amherst, Massachusetts. A new moot. We're finally doing a New England moot. So it's going to be, as I say, in Amherst. I keep saying Amherst, and I know in Massachusetts they don't pronounce the H. I grew up in Amherst with an H, New Hampshire. So I always pronounce it that way, but it's actually Amherst when you're down in Massachusetts. Whatever. But the point is, that's where we're going to be on September 29th. The moot itself is scheduled Did I put the right date? I'm pretty sure I did. Yes, the 29th. It's a Sunday. Sunday the 29th. We usually do our moots on a Saturday. This one's going to be a Sunday for venue reasons. We'll do some stuff on the Saturday night, too, I think, and then we'll have the moot during the day on Sunday. Anyway, it's going to be great fun. Really looking forward to doing a moot up here in New England, where I'm based for the first time. So that's going to be super fun. And then on October 12th will be our third middle moot, where we're going back to Iowa. We started in Iowa, went down to Kansas City last year, which was excellent, and then we're going back up to Iowa this year. So that's going to be great. And Ted Naismith is going to join us at Middle Moot. He is our guest of honor there this year at Middle Moot. So that's going to be super cool. That's going to be really fun. We're looking towards also. So people are always asking about the other moots that we're doing. We're definitely planning Bay Moot in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Magnolia Moot in the Southeast, down in Charlotte, North Carolina. Those will also we don't have definite dates for that yet, but we're looking at fall, like late October, early November for those two moots. So we'll have 4 in the fall, and then we're looking at another 4 in the spring.
We're in the early planning of LA Moot.
That's right. That's right.
And La Moot.
Yep. La Moot. So we're going to be out there probably February, right, is what we're thinking right now?
Well, there was an email that mentioned February, so yeah, that's about as official as it gets.
Exactly. We're not official. Yeah, we're sorting it out. So probably, maybe February. Definitely February, early February, February 8th for Tex Moot. And then we're looking at Orlando in March, and then maybe we're thinking about another ending the year with an adventure moot, basically, in Japan. So working on that. That one's not definite yet. Nippon Moot would be maybe in April this coming year. So really fun. So, Rachel, great question. Do I know where the European moot will be next year? Yes. We're planning to shift it back to the UK. The rough plan at this point is to do like the UK every other year and then alternate on the alternate years to like somewhere down on the continent. Like we did the Netherlands this past year, which was fantastic. So we'll be in the UK again this coming year. We're tentatively shifting that forward. We've done April the last 2 years for our Europe moot, but we're actually thinking of pushing that forward to September. So it's like officially we'll be in the next cycle, but it's still next year. It'll still be in 2020. So we're thinking maybe early September, like Labor Day-ish in America. And we're thinking for the location, we're thinking Wales, actually. It's going to be super cool. Dragon Moot in Wales. That's the tentative plan for Europe Moot next year. That's going to be spectacular. I'm really looking forward to that. So anyway, Tony says that some of you decided if Magnolia Moot is around Halloween, we all have to come in costume. Okay. That would be fun. Rachel, there's a lot of cool connections to a lot of things in Wales. In fact, we might even kind of try to make a special thing of it, actually. More on that later. We don't have the details worked out yet, and it's a ways away. It's more than a year away, more than 12 months away to that. But anyway, that's the plan right now. So it might look like we're sort of skipping Europe, but it's only just because we're going to be moving it to the other side of summer and then maybe keeping it there. We'll see. We'll see what transpires. I'm going 1 year at a time on this, but anyway, okay.
So all sounds very exciting.
Those are the plans. Yeah, we're delighted. Having completed our first round, a full round of regional moots, we did 7 last year, looking to expand maybe to 8 this year, maybe 9 the year after. And we had a really successful year. Not only were the events themselves awesome, as I've been kind of reporting back when I come back from them, but we even, we succeeded on our financial goal, which is breaking even. We broke even on the year. I just, reviewed our books, and we were like, woohoo, we broke even. So we know it works. You know, the theory was sound, but it works. So that was fantastic. I am extra excited for the second year of the rounds of the moots.
Corey, honestly, having participated in organizing one, I can say that breaking even, no small feat.
Yes. It is no small feat, especially since, you know, it's like with me going traveling to all the moots, like I kind of have to cover my travel in the expenses too. But we did. It was great. It was fantastic. And it was perfect. Like we ended up with like a 0.3% surplus. I mean, it was almost exactly even. it was excellent. We did a great job. Everyone was fantastic. Our organizers were super helpful. Did a great job, and it was excellent. So, really excited about that. Would love to. I said this last night when we were talking about it in Mythgard Academy, but I'd love to. There are a couple regions that we're neglecting that I'd love to expand to. I would love to do Maple Moot in Toronto. Or maybe somewhere else. I could be talked into somewhere else in Canada, but Toronto was kind of what I was thinking for Canada. Because then we can also get some parts of the U.S. into that, too. Like, get people able to come in from, like, Buffalo and maybe up from Michigan or something like that. So I'm thinking.
I have an idea.
Toronto, yeah?
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead. No, you're
and the
finished.
Other,
I interrupted
so, and the two other regions I was thinking of, one is the Pacific Northwest. We've never done the Pacific Northwest. So, like, Seattle. I'd love to do Seattle. And then maybe, that part of the Midwest that we're neglecting, like the sort of like Ohio, Pittsburgh area, like further to the eastern part of the Midwest. It would be really cool to have something in that, like vaguely Ohio area would be another thing that I think would be kind of cool. But anyway.
So my idea is, you know, Texas is a big state, right? So we do have Tex Boot, but that's not like Dallas, Houston, you know, Austin. I think we should do like West Texas and call it Boot Scootin' Moot.
Boot Scoot Moot.
See, wasn't that worth it?
That was worth it.
I'm glad we waited.
Yeah, that was totally worth it. Yeah, yeah. Yep. Yeah, Matthias's suggestion that he wants to do one in Vermont so we can call it Vermoot.
Will it be dry Vermoot?
No, it won't be. Or Dime, of course, you know, we also would kind of like to do one up in Alaska, which we would call Remoot. But...
I can see this as an Olsen car traveling game.
Yeah, absolutely.
The kids, right? Like, absolutely. We're going to play the boot game, kids.
That's it. That's it. That's it.
This really should be the guiding principle for how you plan these things, select locations.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Cunning names. That's clearly
names?
It.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, Elise is asking, will there be a virtual options? Like, are we going to do something like Mootcast for the regional moots? We don't have a plan for that at this time. We're still, like, you know, we're still early enough in the process, especially with most of the moots that we're going to be doing this year will be their second time ever through. So we're not yet really wanting to,
Plus you'd have to clone Ed Powell like 15 times.
Well, so. I mean, yeah, trying to get Mootcast together for a regional moot would put some significant additional, logistical pressure on the planning, which I'm not really prepared to bring into play. And I'm not 100% sold actually on the idea for the regional moots. It's not the same as with Myth Moot. So,
at least the way, you know, the way LA Moot worked, I don't know. I guess some of the talks would have been interesting for people to watch online, but like the discussion afterward and stuff, it's like, you wouldn't have been able to hear. It's,
no.
There is sort of a, you know, not to be exclusive or anything, but like there is sort of an element of the regional moots that like the whole point of it is to do it local and live. And all
exactly.
That.
Oh, yeah. I have another one. So if Tex Moot ever falls through, you could have one at my property and call it Way Meat Moot.
Way Meat Moot.
Yes.
Or just Way Moot. Yeah, there you go.
Way Moot.
There you go. Way Moot.
That's it.
Plus, we already have an online moot. It's called The Silmarillion Film Project.
Exactly.
What is it?
That was awesome.
That was the best segue ever. All right, so we're moving into the Dagor Aglareb, episode 9. So, episode 8, we just had the ban, right? We just got to, sort of the political drama. We've had the ban, and we've been thinking about sort of the political fallout from that. Now we have the action sequence, which is kind of the turning point. You know, between the ban and the Dagor Aglareb, those are sort of the sort of major hinge points, in a sense, of the season. Okay, so the first challenge that has been set for us is to make sure that we've got to think through a solution to the problem of sunlight so that Morgoth's armies can move freely throughout Beleriand, because, of course, we begin the season with the sun having just risen and the armies of the orcs being sort of more or less paralyzed by that. So there were discussions earlier on when we were talking about, you know, like what's going on in Angband, for instance. There were discussions about... showing like Gothmog working on a solution to this problem and stuff. And I was not real enthusiastic about the idea of showing, you know, like an orc training montage or something where we're showing them being like, you know, thrown out into the sunlight repeatedly until they can, you know, stand it or something like that. Yeah, Marie points out that sunlight turns trolls to stone, making them less useful in battles. Yes, marginally so, at least. There are two things that I'm thinking here. One, all right, All right, three, counting. Here's my preliminary thing before the two things. The preliminary thing is we can't solve the troll problem, right? Because the troll problem needs to be a Sauron innovation later on. Like, there will be the new species of trolls, which seem to be able to not turn into stone when they go out into the sun. But that's supposed to be a much later addition, right? Something that Sauron develops, which Morgoth doesn't develop. So I think that we need to not solve that problem. We need to keep the trolls turning into stone, or else why are there any stone trolls left? You know, by the time we get to the third, you know, by the time we get to, you know, Bill and you know, the rest of them, of the trolls. So in The Hobbit, so we can't just ignore it. You know, we can't just be like, after some time, the troops of Morgoth just like grin and bear it and go out in the sunshine. We have to think some way through that. But anyway, having said that, Marie, I agree. One clear solution is to block the sun. And I think that we can do that. We can do that in a limited way. Here's the problem. And maybe we raise this, but maybe the battle raises this problem for Morgoth, right? The big problem is that, like, it's hard to do a sneak attack, right? It's hard to take your enemies by surprise when your armies have to be preceded by this giant pall of cloud which blots out the sky, right? It's like a bit of a giveaway. No, I mean, like, you can make it broad enough that, like, they can't tell exactly where you're going, but still, like, oh, looks like it's time for an attack. Here come the clouds again, right? I mean, now, again, like, that can be something which they reflect on after this. We're like, okay, the cloud cover worked great, but we gotta do better, folks, because, you know, sneak attacks would be kind of nice. That's fine.
By the way, where have we got Sauron at this point? Can he create a Dauntless Day? Could this be his first go at creating a Dauntless Day, or did we send him away?
Dauntless Day 1.0. No, he's still around. Yeah. He's still around. And of course, we have Dauntless an obvious kind of machine, right, in the volcanoes, right? I mean, we have these, you know, the volcanic mountains there at Thangarodrim, which are perfectly capable of spewing forth lots of, you know, clouds and ash to be able to do this.
You know, if Morgoth was really smart, what he would have done is to do this on you know, periodically. Like, make it, you know, big clouds come up periodically. True. So they'd never know which one was actually the one.
Just blot out the sun.
Yeah.
That's right. Right. Yeah.
That's true. Lord of the Rings would suggest that that they never did quite get this right, at least the sneak attack part, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah, see, but the whole thing is the dynamics are different in the Third Age, right? Sauron is clearly going for, like, the shock and awe effect, right?
Yeah.
He does the Dauntless Day. Like, so, you know, with Sauron, the message Sauron is sending is, like, you know, doom is descending upon you and there's nothing you can do about it, right? Because he knows that, like, his army's radically out, like, the enemy, his enemy, right, the good guys, are vastly outmanned in his whole thing. So surprise is not his concern, right? If he can have them all terrified, right, and wetting themselves, then, like, that's way better than surprise as far as he's concerned, right, under those circumstances.
Morgoth is doing a surprise.
Rusty armor. Yeah,
right, exactly. Armor. Right, go and change your armor. But the exactly. But yeah, with Morgoth and the Noldor, it's a different situation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, especially again after it's, you know, and this is going to be the battle in which, you know, the bad guys are going to be like, all right, back to the drawing board. We gotta do something different, right? This is just not working. So again, they're in a much more even military situation. In fact, at this point, you could even say the Noldor have the advantage against just orcs, right, in the field. I think that it's definitely a very different situation from the Third Age Dauntless Day stuff. But I agree with it was Marie, yes, who is saying Morgoth comes back into town for this, right? So it's probably him who does the whole, you know, the cloud. And the, I mean, certainly hard to resist a dramatic scene of Morgoth standing there and, like, raising his hand and the volcano erupts and then, you know, and that you know, the ash spews forth and the cloud rolls over the field. And, you know, I'm imagining this, like, this cloud of ash, not just hovering over, right, but kind of, like, rolling over the field, and then you can't see, and then the orcs emerge from the cloud and attack you, you know.
Marie makes a good point, which is the cloud cover's less obvious at night, so he could actually do it at night.
At night, right? Right.
And then, holy crow, when they woke up, it's like, oh, no!
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, no, I think that's, you know, that should definitely happen. But here's the other angle that I wanted to offer on this. Remember, we've been talking about the challenge of conveying visually Morgoth dispersing his power among his followers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that the whole sunlight thing gives us an opportunity for that at some point. Maybe not now, maybe afterwards, right? But we know that the orcs are going to be, they're not going to be marching under clouds the whole time, right? I mean, you know, when, you know, you think about, like, in the Túrin Túrinbar story, right? When, you know, when Túrin and the elves and Nienor, like, are running into random packs of orcs that are roaming around, they're not going around with little black clouds hovering over them, you know, all the time, you know, that's not how it works. So we know before the end of the First Age, the orcs are definitely going to be roaming around in the sunlight, right? They may still avoid bright sunshine, right? They may still camp, like the Misty Mountain orcs still want to in you know, when they're crossing Rohan, right? And the Uruk-hai are driving them on. They just want to hunker down during the sunshine and not run during that time. So we can show them being less active in the middle of the blazing daytime, but still, they're not going to need preternatural cloud cover in order to go outside throughout the First Age. So I'm thinking we have an opportunity, and I'm thinking maybe after the Dagor Aglareb, right? Whether we do that in this season or we wait till season 5, I'm not sure, but we have the opportunity here for Morgoth to make for it to be a thing, right? For him to sit down and say, okay, the orcs need to be, I'm going to strengthen the orcs. And you know, Gothmog, Sauron could ask, like, how are you going to do that? Right. You know, they have an issue with sunshine. And he says, you know, like this, right? And he'd Sauron can even comment on it, maybe, you know, something like, you know, isn't, you know, with all respect, sir, isn't that going to weaken you? Aren't you, like, you know, kind of, I don't know. We don't want it to be too awkward, but don't worry. Our script people can handle making that not awkward. But, what I'm saying is that I think that we could make there be a discreet jump in the resistance of orcs to sunlight, and it gives us an opportunity to show a specific occasion of Morgoth putting forth his power in that particular way that we were having a hard time
that's a good idea
for that. So anyway, good.
I like this idea of having Sauron comment on it too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it gives us the opportunity to, again, like, you know, obviously we want to avoid hokiness, but it gives us the opportunity to do, like, a little bit of exposition on, like, that, how that distribution of power thing works. Cause it's going to be, we don't want to make it, like, campy and, like, make it look like somebody was, Rachel was saying the original orc power up, right? We don't want it to look too video game like, right? With them getting a power up, you know.
By the power of Grayskull!
right, exactly.
Yes, exactly,
Tony. And we could have Morgoth physically change at that point again. Like, he would, from that point, he would look a little different than he did before.
Right.
So anyway, like I said, I don't know what the timing for that, whether we want that to be in the, I mean, I assume after the disaster of the Dagor Aglareb, the bad guys are going to like regroup and debrief, right? Afterwards, yeah. Maybe it, you know, does it happen right away then? Is Glaurung like phase one of the post Dagor Aglareb upgrade program? And then the upgrade of the orcs is phase two of that. And then he, you know, and that's what then initiates, you know, so we've got the, you know, in the Dagor Bragolach, right? We've got unleash flames and Balrogs, right? Unleash full-grown Glaurung and release upgraded orcs, right? And that's the sort of triple whammy that sweeps across northern Beleriand. So anyway, that's... I think my impulse is to save it for Season 5 as part of the build-up to the Dagor Bragolach, the anticipation of that. But just, that's the main thing I was thinking of, that, like, I'm totally fine doing, you know, the, as Tony said, the beta version of the Dawnless Day here at the Dagor Aglareb, but I definitely think that, you know, we need to be thinking in these terms down the road.
Well, and I think the Dawnless Day would be consistent with what the text says as well about sort right. of the attack being you know sort of telegraphed by earthquakes and volcanoes mm-hmm. spewing and stuff, and it's like they you know like this is one of those cases where the compression in the text sort of like they indicated as without warning these things happened and suddenly the armies poured forth, but if you think about how that would really work physically in an actual physical world with geography, those sorts of things happening would definitely make it pretty clear to elves who are miles and miles away that something's happening and there's an attack coming.
Right.
So,
right. Yes.
So I think at least in this case, the Dawnless Day sort of giving away the surprise as it were actually makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not like it's the whole reason that it fails, but it's a part of the picture, you know? And again, they will see that. 'Cause again, one of the things that, and one of the senses that you get from the text, right, is that in the Dagor Aglareb, Morgoth is still, he doesn't really, nobody really knows the full military strength of the Noldor and the Sindar, right? I mean, like, how much are they going to be able to take? So he keeps probing, right? And this is sort of the last stage of the probing before he, having done his, you know, field research, he prepares, you know, the overwhelming attack of the Dagor Bragolach. You know, it would be part of the thing, right? You know, that he would be doing clearly, right? Is, you know, taking notes and being like, okay, so, you know, the whole like Dawnless Day thing was cool and everything, and it kind of worked, you know, it worked in some ways, but, you know, maybe we need to go a different direction in order to make sure that, you know, we can overwhelm and surprise them better. Marie, I think somebody was a little bit earlier on saying that, of course, if the attack is initiated at night, you know, if the clouds covering the skies come across it, and it's not going to be quite so obvious, which is true. But again, remember elves, it's not like they're not out at night. Right. And they'll notice the stars being.
Yeah, I was thinking about that they'd be out admiring the stars and suddenly there'd be this thing covering them up.
Right. So, and yeah. I mean, that's really kind notice. Of a cool, I mean, so imagine this, right? It's, I don't know if we've made it. We haven't, have we made, did we talk about the Valakirka in season one? Did we talk about the stars, right? The sickle of the Valar set in the north, right? I'm glad. I was hoping we talked about that, Marie. If we were to show the sickle of the Valar being consumed, right, by the darkness, right, the clouds spreading from the north and covering first, you know, the Big Dipper, the sickle of the Valar, and then, you know, the stars vanishing, that's kind of thinking back to the whole Melkor Varda thing in season one. That's kind of fun, actually, right? That's kind of neat symbolism.
Yeah.
Especially if somebody who kind of gets that can be seeing it, right? Maybe Fingolfin, right, is looking out and he sees this happen and, you know, and he sort of realizes the significance. And anyway, yeah, so they're going to be, and, you know, Maedhros is certainly going to be on guard and not going to be surprised by the attacks. But yeah, so I think let's do the Dauntless Day thing. I really like the visual effect of having the Dauntless Day come in at night. Not only because I like that visual effect of the darkness eating up the stars, right? And then, you know, when day comes, we have the cloud cover in place and the clouds of ash. You know, descending on everything from the volcanoes.
It feels a little different from what we've seen before with the Lord of the Rings, which is kind of nice.
Exactly, especially with the rains and ash, it won't be the same. Yeah,
yeah, and it's a little more. It feels a little more elvish by doing it sort of.
Yeah, at night with the stars vanishing. Yes, exactly. Yeah. It is a little bit more elvish that way. Yes. Okay. So, so the attacks. We're going to have four different battles, right? Four different fronts in the battle. They're going to come down the Gap of Sirion and attack Minas Tirith, which I still really am not sure we want to actually call it that. Do we? Would we be too worried about... I mean, it's hard, because on the one hand, like, it's a little bit awesome, obviously, to show this is, like, the inspiration for the future Minas Tirith. But... I don't know. Nick and Marie are both suggesting we just call it the Tower of Guard. We don't actually call it Minas Tirith, because we don't want to... Yeah. Okay, I'm cool with that.
Oh, yeah, because otherwise it'd be totally confusing.
Well,
yeah.
I'm worried about confusion. Exactly. Tony says we already have a Denethor, right? So, yeah. Exactly, yeah. We don't want the average viewer to think it's the same place. Is the problem there.
Of course, I mean, you know, the next Minas Tirith is going to show up in, what, 10 years, maybe? 12?
Maybe.
In Gondor?
Yeah, maybe. Something like that.
Season 26. So it might not be. I don't know. No, I think Tower of the Guard is probably good.
Yeah, I would just call it Tower of Guards. Anyway, so they're going to come down the Gap of Sirion and attack the Tower of Guard. They're going to attack Maglor's Gap. They're going to attack Dorthonion. And they're going to come down around the coast and attack, like, I would think maybe Nevrast, since we've already invested in Nevrast for the festival, right, earlier on this season. Showing that place, which was the place of celebration before under attack, would be a good thing. And of course, that would be a very appropriate place to have the maximum cooperation between the Sindar and the Noldor, right? So I'm thinking Círdan comes in from the sea, right, with ships from the sea and rescues Nevrast from attack. Just brainstorming there about how that could work, so that we have some very active cooperation there between the Sindar and the Noldor. So here's my question. Are we 100% sure that we want to do it this way?
Well, you mean with the at night with the cloud cover, or you mean
No, I mean the massive attack on four fronts.
Ah. What's your hesitation?
The alternative would be to make it a little bit smaller scale, which would make it a little bit more manageable to do in one episode.
That's true.
Also, here's the other thing. I want, for a couple reasons, I want there to be a clear contrast between the Dagor Aglareb and the Dagor Bragolach, right? And obviously the presence of Glaurung is a major difference. But the upgraded orcs are a difference too. But
But I see what you're saying, like, in terms of storytelling on the screen, those things won't make it obvious to the average viewer that mm-hmm. things are different this time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas scaling things up, you know, increasing like the scope of the battle.
Yes.
Would, you know, like the fact that if this one seems dangerous, but it's like, you know, kind of a little bit smaller scale and it's just focused on these locations and the elves throw it back. It's like, oh, okay. But like, you know, if at the start of the Bragalach, we have this visual where we show all these simultaneous attacks happening and the armies are more massive and there's dragons and all that, then that like, that immediately, like this sense of dread sets in to the viewer. They're like, "Oh crap!"
Exactly. See, because there are a couple things that I'm thinking here. Also, one is the elves are going to get a little overconfident after this battle, right? The elves are going to be like, "See, look, we can handle this." But I think what would be really cool, especially thinking about the themes of the season, right? It would be really cool if it's not just a, hey, like, one-on-one, the orcs can, the elves totally kick the orcs' butts, right? We're fine here, right? It's not just that, right? What if the defeat of Morgoth's forces in the Dagor Aglareb is not only a result of the, like, you know, military supremacy on the field of the elvish armies, but also they coordinate to crush it, right? So we show the elves effectively working together, which is why Fingolfin and Finrod, for instance, afterwards are all about, like, yeah, see? Like, if we join together, we can prevent, like, we can hold Morgoth and Ligur indefinitely, right? All we have to do is put our differences aside and join together and cooperate, and this is, yeah, and we can do this, right, together. If that's the message that they take from the Dagor Aglareb. So this is why what I'm thinking of, instead of having them attacked on, like, many, many different fronts, like will happen in the Dagor Bragalach, we have a more concentrated attack, which then the armies of the elves can coordinate and meet, right? And so the enemy is completely routed, not like immediately right away. There can be drama here, right? You know, we can make it interesting and exciting, but we have a resounding victory that is the result of excellent cooperation among the different elvish armies, right? But and so, Dave, to the point that you were making just a minute ago, the Dagor Bragalach will be different because the elves will be prevented from coordinating because they're being attacked on all fronts. Each one of them is trying by themselves to protect their own homes. You know, so, you know, Angrod and Ignor are being completely swept away on Dorthonion and no help is coming. They're hoping for help to come, right? They're hoping Fingolfin is going to come and help them. They're hoping that Maglor, or, you know, that Maglor and Mithras are going to be able to come help them, and nobody comes because they're all under attack on their home fronts as well, right? And the orcs are bursting through the gap of Sirion, and nobody can do anything about it. So, so this is why I'm thinking I want to scale it down a little bit. Now, I agree, Brian, we don't want to scale it down too much. We don't want it to just look like a skirmish. Absolutely not. Brian Dimmick was saying, you know, we want the Dagor Aglareb to seem big enough to be a potential knockout punch from Morgoth. It's not just a warm-up to the Dagor Bragalach. I agree.
This is more just like being mindful of not making it so big that when it comes time to do the Bragalach, we're like, oh, crap.
Exactly.
we can't make it any bigger.
Right, exactly. I think it should feel not only are the enemies themselves stronger because there's the dragon and the orcs are stronger and everything, but like the entire scale of the battle should feel much bigger. And again, they should be prevented. The elves should be prevented from coordinating in the Dagor Bragalach.
I also think if you're thinking about sort of planning ahead, storytelling, that kind of stuff, we can also do, as you were saying, like how do we do this so that we can fit it into one episode and it makes sense? And with what we can do is just plan ahead for Bragalac. We can deal with sort of the difficulty of having multiple locations and stuff by just saying that one's going to be multi-episode. That's going to be a multiple episode thing.
Right.
Like because there's so many interesting things happening. There's so much interesting fallout we want to cover. We're just going to go ahead and give ourselves the time and space to do that. But mm-hmm. we don't want to do that yet. Like we want to save it.
Right. Okay. So good. Yeah, I agree with that. We'll see what happens there. Now, Nick is concerned that we seem to be reducing a lot of episodes this season to a single plot line. Yeah, and I don't necessarily think we have to do that here, Nick. And so when I talk about simplifying things, I don't mean... So I agree with Brian, this shouldn't just be... Like, we shouldn't just make it look like a skirmish, right? It needs to be a major thing. And I know, Marie, I know that there is a... you know, sort of a pincher movement thing going on here. And Rhiannon was reminding us that we are also kind of combining in, we're folding in another, remember that little foray that the orcs make down along the coast, right? Which gets foiled. We're kind of folding that in here. Even though that was actually quite separate from the Dagor Aglareb didn't get a name among the great, right? It wasn't counted among the great battles. Exactly. Marie says it's 100 years later. So we're kind of folding that in here, too. So so here's my thought, because we've got another challenge here, too. Right. And that is Aethelos and the spell of Bottomless Dread. So we've got Aethelos, who is been placed under the spell of Bottomless Dread. We had her have the whammy put on her in an earlier episode. And we wanted to make her an unwilling puppet who aids Angband's forces in some way under the influence of the spell of Bottomless Dread. We wanted her to be an unwilling traitor to the Elvish cause. So thinking of these several factors. So we have one, I'd kind of like to concentrate the attack a little bit so that we're not fighting on all fronts, because I want to save that for the Dagor Bragalac. That's one thing. The other thing, I agree with Brian, we do want to show that there needs to be some kind of tactical or like strategic cunning involved here. This can't just be a stupid attack by the enemy. This does need to be something which, like, if it worked, it would have been devastating. And we should show it come close to working, right? So that's another thing. A third thing, we want to get in the attack down the coast, right? Something like that sneak attack that is sort of sneak attack down the coast that is being made. I think we can combine all of these things, right? So here's my suggestion.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's advocating for like really reducing this or making it trivially small,
right?
Because it needs to be big, because it needs to be big enough that it looks scary.
Yes.
So that when the next one happens, it's terrifying.
It's completely terrifying. Yes, absolutely. Right. Absolutely. The Dagor Bragalac should really be, until we get to the War of Wrath, I think, the single biggest battle. Like, the Nirnaeth Arnoediad is a big deal, but the Nirnaeth Arnoediad is a bigger deal, not because it's like a more devastating battle, but because it's like more tragic. Like there's like the casualty level is way, way higher. People are driven back and scattered and everything in the Dagor Bragalac, but like, you know, number of like, you know, people being slaughtered is a bigger deal in the Nirnaeth Arnoria. But the Dagor Bragalac, I'm thinking, is really like the largest scale offensive we ever show Morgoth putting forth, essentially.
Yeah. Right. So if this one's too big, then when we start doing the Bragalac, people look, it'll look exactly the same.
Yes.
And it'll be unclear why did it work this time?
Right. Why it worked. Exactly. That was exactly what I'm concerned about there. Okay. So here's my thought about how the strategy could work. What if the primary attack, basically we reduce, Sauron's and Marie here, I'm thinking of still doing something like, I'm kind of combining the sort of pincher movement that Morgoth does in the text at the Dagor Aglareb, like around both sides of Dorthonion. So keeping the pincher movement concept, but also integrating the attack by the orcs down the coast, right? What if we combined all of these things, right? And we have the primary push of Morgoth's orc forces down through the gap of Sirion, right? And so Minas Tirith, which we don't call that, the Tower of Guard, right, takes the primary brunt of the assault from Morgoth, right? And his goal is to... What's his goal? His, you know, ideally, that sort of crushes them, right? But he knows it's going to attract... He's going to try to draw people down from Hithlum, over from Nevrast, right, to try to fight off his main army. Meanwhile, he's going to sneak the other group around from behind, come along the coast, right, sack Nevrast, and then come and take their armies from behind with that second force, right? So that he then, like, you know, takes the all of the support of the elves. Maybe he's going to bank on the fact that nobody's going to come from Doriath, right? So he's like, okay, the Sons of Feanor are too far away. Nobody's going to help from Doriath, right? So we're fine on the eastern flank of this army, right? It's the western and northern flanks that we got to worry about, because army's going to come down from Hithlum, army's going to come over from Nevrast, right? So we'll bring this other army around behind all of them, right? And they'll sneak up and they'll succeed in attacking. And so that's what gets thwarted then, that's what gets thwarted by Círdan, right? The elves of Nevrast also can be involved there. And so the second force gets destroyed, and then maybe the other thing that happened, maybe the Sons of Feanor get there, right? Morgoth doesn't expect them to get there, but they do, right? So we can have Maedhros showing up. And in fact, hey, how about this, right? We can set up the Nirnaeth Arnoediad this way, right? Where we have the forces of, like, Fingon and Fingolfin here in the east, and they're, like, hoping against hope that that Maedhros will appear, and he does, right? Maedhros and his forces do appear from the east, and they do take the enemy between them and crush them. And so that's basically the success that they're trying to replicate in the Nirnaeth Arnoediad down the road, right? Except the second time when we show Fingon watching and hoping for the banners of Maedhros to appear, they don't appear, right? The second time.
Nice.
And the tragedy occurs. So what do we think about that? We'd need to have a reason, like a not a mechanism exactly, but we would need to show. So here you go, Nick. Here's a B plot for this episode. The B plot is the vigilance of Maedhros, right? Maedhros has to A, note that an attack is taking place. B, figure out exactly what's happening and what he needs to do. And C, get his army across, right, marching them north of Doriath, right, and get them through, you know, bring them through that area and bring them to the battle in time, right? They've got to march double quick across. So Marisa, she's fine with the Feanorians being vigilant enough and willing to travel enough to get there in time to help. So they achieve this wonderful accomplishment, which, and everyone is amazed. Like, even Morgoth is taken by surprise. Nobody thinks they can cross that terrain in time, right? And they do, right? So we can have a B plot of, like, you know, Maedhros, you know, getting the Feanorians there, right? We will also have another plot of the battle that's happening on the other side. So now, what do you guys think about that as a general kind of tactical situation? Exactly, Marie. Hope unlooked for, right? That's what they, you know, they think they're going to have to do it, and it's going to be close, right? Maybe they can fight off this Orc horde themselves. And then they get news that there's one coming up behind them, and they're like, oh man, we're in huge trouble. But then they get foiled, right, by the unexpected arrival of Círdan and the Sindar from the Havens. And then the Feanorians show up as, like, the final eucatastrophe at the Dagor Aglareb. And at that point, the orcs are just crushed, right? Now they're taken between the armies of Turgon and Fingolfin and Finrod, right? So then Finrod sallies forth from the gates, you know, like Thorin Oakenshield, right? And you've got, Fingolfin and Fingon and Turgon on one side, and then Maedhros and Maglor and the other, and Celegorm come on the other side and just crush, right? And we just, the orcs get absolutely destroyed there at the end. But it can look kind of tense for Finrod in the Tower of Guard there for a while. Especially when Fingolfin isn't sure if he's going to have to turn and face the other orc army that's coming up from behind and leave so he's going to look like he's facing a decision, maybe, right? Like, do I leave Finrod on his own, or do I, is it going to look like we're betraying our kin again, right? And refusing to help him or failing to help him, right? And then instead of the potential conflict there, we get like a big community effort, right? From Círdan and the Sindar, the Noldor are all working together, the Fëanorians coming in, everybody's happy and everything works. Marie says, what makes the Battle of Pelennor Fields good writing is that the tide of battle turns multiple times in surprising ways. So if we could set up something like that, it would be very impressive storytelling. Yeah, no, I think we've got some real potential for this to... And by concentrating the action in this one place instead of scattering it elsewhere, then we accomplish, I think, a couple things. We accomplish what Dave and I were talking about keeping it from looking like the Dagor... Bragolac, so that will look fundamentally different when we get there. Two, we get to establish a really different kind of narrative with this story, and a narrative which is very closely in keeping with the themes of the season, right? Of reconciliation and forgiveness and coming together, right? And we set up both of those future disastrous battles really, really well, right? We set up the Dagor Bragolac because now when... You know, we can have parallels, right? We can show, like, there will be a bunch of people who will be under siege like Finrod was under siege, you know, in this battle, right? But instead of the reinforcements showing, instead of the Fëanorian cavalry, you know, coming over the rise and sweeping down on the enemy, nobody comes, right? Because everybody is tied down where they are, right? And then, of course, as I said, we set up even more clearly the Nirnaeth Arnoediad. So I think that has a lot of potential. Now, I was being a little bit hand-waving about the other side, the other force, the coastal force, the sneak attack by Morgoth. And of course, that's the other way that you do a sneak attack under the cloud cover, right? You put out this very large and impressive force, which is the primary attack, right, of the Dagor Aglareb, and they think that's your attack, right? So they, you know, but the cloud cover is general over the whole region, so you can bring the other army in around using the same cloud cover, and, you know, they don't see that coming. Okay, so what is the objective of the other army? If the objective of the other army is to come around behind... It's got to go all the way around, right? It's got to come in past Nevrast, right? A little awkward geographically, but maybe we can do that. They would just bypass Hithlum. Now, again, in this, I'm trying to come back to Aethelos here. We need to think of a role that she's meant to play. A way in which she can, though, without her full consent, right, betray the other Noldor. What key role would a single person play in helping to make that? There's not a opening the gate to the enemy kind of situation exactly, which was my first thought, but with this kind of movement of armies, we're not talking about a fortress being betrayed from within. Yeah, Nick is saying if her mind is truly broken, it should be something very simple. Well, but see, Nick, I don't think her mind being broken doesn't mean that she's like just non compos mentis at this point, right? It would mean her will is broken. Like her, you know, she is her will is enslaved to Morgoth. So she would be functional, totally functional. I don't think she looks like she's been driven mad by this. It's only her will that is broken. Yeah. Okay.
So would she kind of appear normal? I mean, in terms of like...
I think she would. I think she would appear normal.
So no one would know.
Yes.
Really?
I mean, there would be people who might suspect.
Suspect.
Like, there's something that ain't right with her.
Something's off. Know? Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, we can have her. I'm okay. So Nick and Marie are talking about, like, you know, before we were, you know, they were thinking of having her like in an almost catatonic state when they pick her up, like when she's found wandering. I'm okay with that, but I think she should look to be getting better. Like, again, I don't think the spell of bottomless dread, I mean, the clearest instance of the spell of bottomless dread that we have is Maeglin, right? Maeglin is totally functional. Right now, his own will is engaged in a different way, but he is still placed under the spell of bottomless dread. He is not weak-willed.
I also don't want to make it too much like Turin-Turambar's sister, her name is Nienor.
Yes, Nienor, yes, exactly.
Because she's going to be kind of catatonic when they find her,
yes,
right?
I mean, that is a different thing. What Glaurung does to her is a different thing,
right?
From this. So, yeah.
Right, so we don't want it to be too similar to that.
Then. Yeah, that's what I'm
thinking. No, we don't want it to be too similar to that. But like I said, the spell of bottomless dread, it's not just I'm going to break your mind. Like, I'm going to drive you insane. It's, I'm going to enslave your will. You will become my creature. You will become my puppet. You will like, when you lie in bed at night, you will hear me whispering in your ear, you know, when you, like wherever they go, you know, the will of Morgoth is with them, right? Whispering to them, and they can't resist, right? They're like, when they're under the spell... They are not their own masters, right? They have been dominated by Morgoth. That's the state that Evelos is in. I think pointing to the fact that something happened, you know, so that, like, have her look, I mean, to have her be catatonic and wandering is fine, but I think she needs to get better, right? I mean, this has doubtless been a really bad experience in lots of different ways, right? So there's every, you know, there's no reason for those who pick her up to be, there's no reason, for the people who pick her up to think that, I mean, they're not going to be suspicious, right? They're going to be like, great, she's had a horrible traumatic experience, right? And, but then they nurse her back to health and she's, exactly. So, yep. I think that's how we can do that. So what can she do? So hang on. So Rhiannon had given us a couple suggestions that she made on the discussion boards, which I was kind of looking through a little bit. It's really hard because on the open field, there aren't opportunities for her to... like sabotage defensive structures or let people into strongholds. There isn't really, it's kind of hard to see how she would be in a position, even, you know, I mean, she can be a very important person, but she's not going to, like, convince Fingolfin to not come to battle, right? They're advancing. Besides which, the strategy that I was laying out, Morgoth wants them to come, like Morgoth wants Turgon and Fingolfin to come into the field against his forces in the south so that the other force can then come up behind and destroy them, right? He wants to lure them out into the field and then crush them between his two forces. So he wouldn't want them to stay back. With this particular strategy that I'm describing, he would not want them to stay in Hithlum, right? So that can't really be it either. Rhiannon, of your suggestions, my favorite thing and the thing which seems to me most workable would be, under the circumstances that I've been describing, is to either pass along a false report or prevent messengers coming.
Prevent the messengers from coming, maybe by intercepting them and then saying, well, give me the message. I'll pass it along. Something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. Or even, we could even have it. She could even kill the messenger. Like, you know, that could happen.
I was thinking that too.
Just to sort of show, it would convey much more clearly the, like, Morgoth is driving the bus right here, you know, for her to be acting in a way which is not just counter to the best interests of her allies and relatives, but to be acting in a, like, pronouncedly, clearly non-elvish way. And of course, as Tony points out, especially in the light of the kinslaying, her killing the messenger is kind of a, you know, would work.
True.
So yeah, if the good guys are going to win by coordinating efforts, disrupting messages would be harmful. Exactly.
That's what I was going to say. You said in a non-Elvish way. I'm like, yeah, except for the Sons of Fëanor. Well,
when I say non-Elvish, you know, I don't mean unprecedented, right? Yeah. Oh, interesting. Rhiannon says she could prevent a message requesting help from being sent to the Fëanorians so that Maedhros' arrival would be more surprising and due entirely to his own vigilance. You know, like they. He didn't receive the message, but he comes anyway.
Oh, that's perfect. That would set up the audience to believe that he won't arrive.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And that would be a nice, it'd be a very nice kind of reversal if we set the audience up to expect that help won't arrive this time, and it does. And then so going in.
And then we expect it to arrive, and then it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now, Maria is reminding us that she is Angrod's wife, and Angrod has the grudge with Carinthir. So it would be. There's some opportunities there with the Fëanorians. You know, it would certainly be easy for her to convince her husband that the Fëanorians are not going to come, right? Because he would be inclined to suspect that, you know, those loser Fëanorians aren't going to come. And Marie says it might sort of seem in character-ish, maybe. But again, I think it should be discovered. Because that can be the moment of, like, near despair, right? When Fingolfin realizes, you know, holy cow, the messenger that we sent to Maedhros, you know, has been murdered and he doesn't even know. And this, you know, here we were hoping he was going to come and now, you know, like there's now no hope that he's going to come. So they find the messenger dead in a ditch. Exactly. And then, you know, the truth comes out. Yeah, I was kind of thinking of having her involved on the other side, like having her involved in somehow, like that she would be deployed by Morgoth as part of the strategy with the flanking army coming around. But I like the Fëanorians, but especially with Angrod, her and everything. Yeah, yeah. Marie says it's the Red Arrow messenger all over again. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Rohan cannot come. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes, exactly. Rohan cannot come. We will have a Rohan cannot come now. There is no hope moment there in the Dagor Aglareb. Okay. So, yeah, I like that. I like that. I think that that all works well. The capture of Rog and Anile. Yeah. So my thought here is that Rog gets captured in battle, right? He gets dragged off in battle, and Anile maybe just vanishes, but people don't know. So there's like, did he like get captured in battle or something? People don't know, but I would love to see like Tevildo and or Thorin and Gwethil just nab him, right, at some point. But anyway, you know, I could sort of see it in either way. Oh yeah, no, Rachel, we did. I've forgotten it already, though. We did decide on a new name for Rog. I forgot what we did. Somebody remind me the new name for Rog we decided on last time. Rolgrin. Yeah, we decided on the sort of the standard Rolgrin, because I really like Rog and I still want him to be. I'm going to call him Rog for short, no matter what we name him. So better to have that. Have that happen.
The character formerly known as Rog.
The character always in my mind still known as Rog.
That's right,
yeah,
I think
exactly.
That's what Marie called him last time. So yeah, always in Corey's mind is Rog.
Exactly. That's it. Okay. So Nick, what does the battle look like? Let me see if I can lay it out again more clearly. The clouds sweep forth in the night. The armies of the orcs advance, and they charge right down the gap of Sirion, their goal being to divide the east from the west and to draw the armies of Hithlum and Nevrast to them while they're pinning Finrod down at Minas Tirith, right? So they come in comparatively overwhelming numbers. That is overwhelming, certainly, to Minas Tirith, right? So Minas Tirith is heavily besieged and in significant danger, right? So Finrod is pinned down at Minas Tirith by the big army that has come down. Seeing this happening, right, the armies of like Fingolfin and Fingon and Turgon both get their armies together and they come down from the from the north and from the west, right? So they come to it and they're prepared to attack the army from this side. This is when they're like, okay, let's send a message over to Maedhros as quick as possible. It's probably not going to get there in time. And by the time it gets there and then they get back, you know, there's Hirgun of Gondor said, right, maybe you can disturb the orcs, from their looting of Minas Tirith, right? Yeah, but anyway, so the Fëanorns will probably come too late, but let's send a desperate, message out there, right? Meanwhile, the second army of orcs, which should be very large, but not as big as the main one, right? So it's a secondary force, but it's still a very significant force, as meanwhile has stolen a march. Maybe they started earlier, right? And they've been coming down along the coast. So they come down along the coast and they're gonna sack Nevrast, I think. They're gonna like set Nevrast on fire and then come in and attack the armies of Turgon and Fingolfin from behind, right? So that now the armies have caught the High King of the Elves and like the bulk of the non-Feanorian Noldor forces in this pincher movement of their own, right? On the field there and crush them. That's Morgoth's strategy, and the Feanorians are out of the picture because they're too far away. That's why he rushes down. If he stays up in Dorthonion, you know, Maedhros can come right over, right? So he doesn't. He just comes straight down, all the way down to Minas Tirith so that they're further away. And he's also banking on the fact that Thingol's going to do nothing, right? That Thingol is not going to leave Doriath, so there's no threat coming from that area. So he, Morgoth, only has to focus on the western front of his battle, right? As both Fingolfin and Fingon and Turgon come together over on that side, and that's when Morgoth is going to sweep around from behind. So yes, on the field near Minas Tirith is where all these battles are happening, like just north of Minas Tirith there in the gap of Sirion. So, but then of course what happens is the army of orcs that's sneaking up from behind is thwarted. And The Fanorians do get there in time, and then so then we have the final battle with instead the orc force being taken between Fingolfin with Fingon and Turgon on the one side, and Finrod sallying forth out of Minas Tirith, and Mithros' cavalry sweeping down from the east, and the orcs are completely crushed, and they win, and everyone's good. And so Evelos's role is preventing the messenger, killing the messenger who gets sent to Mithros, so that they think they're not coming. Here are the two weak parts in my strategy here that I need help with. Number one, we haven't involved the folks from Dorthonion, and obviously Angrod has to be involved if Evelos is going to be there at all, right? So I think we have to have Angrod and Ignor leaving Dorthonion and basically following in the, you know, pursuing the trail of the orcs, right? So the orcs march quickly straight down and attack Minas Tirith, and Angrod and Ignor would have to join with Fingolfin, right, who's coming out from Hithlum, and the two of them come down the gap behind the orcs, trying to attack, and then Turgon comes out from Nevrast. So, Nick, yes, Turgon would not be in Nevrast when it was attacked, because, again, the goal would be to take them all in the, you know, to, he's trying to draw them all out into the field there around Minas Tirith and then destroy them with the second force that comes in. Banking on the strength of the first force, the separation from the Fëanorians, and then the unexpected attack from behind by the second force. That's the strand. And by the way, that second force could also have with it some of Sauron's troops. Right, we could have like werewolves and like Tevildo, you know, and his cats could be in the field. I mean, we could have. It's like this is the sneakier force, right? It's still orcs, still mostly orcs, but we can have like, you know, werewolves and stuff like that coming through here, which would be kind of fun because if Círdan then comes and helps destroy this army, then we have Círdan like Círdan's revenge against the werewolves, right? No Balrogs, though. Absolutely right. No Balrogs in that second army. The Balrogs are all with the first army. All right. So, Nick, nobody needs to pursue Turgon anywhere. Turgon is coming to them, right? Everything happens right there outside Minas Tirith. Why stay on the coast, right? The enemy is inland, right? So Turgon is going to leave Nevrast behind and come in to join forces with Fingon and Fingolfin and Angrod and Ignor, right, who have all come down. So they're going to try to form this army, which will attack the orcs from one side, but again, they're hoping the Fëanorians will come, but they probably won't, right? So Turgon is not in Nevrast. He's there. So he's with Fingolfin, right? They're like same army there. Marie wants no Balrogs on the field at all. Right. If Balrogs are in the battle, someone needs to die. Yeah. Well, let's come back to that. Hang on a second. Okay. Right. Okay, so here is the other weak point in my strategy. How are we going to defeat the coastal army? The coastal army can be exposed, but we need to defeat it outright. Círdan's coming is like the eucatastrophic moment, right? When Círdan and his ships sail up, and the army of the Sindar can't take them on alone. So maybe what we need to have is Turgon. So Turgon leaves Nevrast and marches east to join Fingolfin. Maybe what happens is he gets word, or even this is Turgon, right? Does he have some premonition or something? Right? He could have a foreseeing that he must return to Nevrast or something. Right. So instead of continuing on to the east and just joining his army with Fingolfin, which is what Morgoth intends him to do and which he's setting out to do. Right. Instead, he's like, no, something tells me I need to turn back towards Nevrast. And so Círdan comes in and Turgon comes back and the two of them collaborate on crushing the second smaller sneak orc army in the field there. And then Turgon can continue up to join Fingolfin for the final battle. Tony is wondering if Ulmo could intervene here. That seems possible. Yeah, Marie says maybe Turgon returns to Vinyamar because he dreams of his wife calling him back there or something. Yeah, something like that. That could totally work. So exactly, Nick, the coastal orc army never gets to Minas Tirith, right? So the big stratagem, Morgoth's big stratagem, fails, right? It will be thwarted. But it still doesn't look great. I mean, it's still like no better than even odds on the field because that big army is big, right? And Finrod is pinned down inside and it doesn't look like... And so it's only when the Feanorians come sweeping in, or the Feanorian cavalry comes in, that now, like, the what looked like a tough slog turns into a rout for the elves. Tony's suggesting maybe Ossie helps Círdan. I kind of like the idea, Tony. Ossie is actually a great suggestion. Ossie kind of breaking the rules and taking a part in the battle would work, right? But anyway, the other thing that I like about it, Tony, is remember one of the message, you know, like one of the sort of morals of the story is that like that is of the coastal attack is that it like. Morgoth trying to do things by sea never pans out, right? At no point does he ever have a navy or an air force, right, until the very end. And so, like, the sea is just, like, he's not going to mess with the sea, right? So if we really kind of bring that message home, right, like, and this will be the last time that you will bring an army of orcs onto the coast, right? You will think twice before you ever bring an army of orcs anywhere within 5 miles of the ocean ever again. That would actually be kind of cool, I think. Yeah. So, Tony, we could have a dramatic natural effect there as well. One challenge there is if we have Círdan in his ships, we're not going to want Ossie to get too frisky, right? Or else the ships of the Teleri are not going to handle that super well. But anyway, we can kind of try to sort that out. Maybe they can sort of shelter behind the, the breakwater in Vinyamar or something when Ossie's counterattack comes or something. Anyway, I'm not 100% sold on the Ossie idea, but I kind of like it. I kind of like the idea of that intervention in some way. Participating there. So Nick, back to your question, and I it's fine, I totally appreciate your pressing on the details here. The orc army is at the gates of Minas Tirith for some time. It's not like a long, they're not like encamped for a super long siege. It's an assault, but it's an assault that lasts for, you know, days and weeks. So they're not just besieging the place. They're attacking because it looks like they could take it. I mean, Minas Tirith needs to be in danger of falling, not of being starved out or something, in danger of being taken by the orc army, which is going to be continually introducing an element of urgency, right? Fingolfin's council can all be like, can we wait for that? How long should we wait for the Feanorians? Will they come? Will they come? Let's wait. But then like they can't wait forever. I hope that's enough to work with. If you think that this would work well, Aignor needs to break his sword in the battle. That's manageable. We can make that happen. Back to the Balrog's question. Marie points out that Thorin Gwethil in her spying saw Finrod's plans for Minas Tirith earlier on. So, Thorin Gwethil can do some skullduggery there at Minas Tirith. Okay. Balrog question. Here's my problem. I get you, and I remember we made a pledge that any time a Balrog comes into battle, somebody, a named character, has to die, right? That was our Balrog rule. Here's my problem. Why on earth would the Balrogs not come? why would Morgoth be like, okay, I'm going to try to do, as Brian said, a knockout punch, right? I'm going to send this overwhelming force down the Vale of Sirion and crush Minas Tirith. But I'm going to, the Balrogs, I'm just going to keep them home, like, knitting instead while this is happening. Like, why on earth would he do that? How could that possibly make sense? I can't make any sense of that. Which means we have a couple options. One is to kill somebody in this battle, right?
That's the most obvious option.
That's the most obvious option. Rhiannon is saying maybe the Balrogs were all required to help with the creation of Glaurung, except I don't think we're creating Glaurung yet. I think the creation of Glaurung comes as a response to the Dagor Aglareb.
Maybe Morgoth has them up at the volcano flapping their wings to make the cloud.
Flap.
Oh, he's gonna just mute me. He's just gonna mute me from the thing.
See, I don't think the Balrogs drive the orcs from behind in general.
I think we talked about that, didn't we? That they'd be like in the vanguard.
I gotta think they mostly do. Yeah, I mean, Gothmog... Well, no, Gothmog isn't in the doghouse yet. We were going to put him in the doghouse because the Dagor Aglareb was going to be his plan, and it was going to not work. Besides which, I mean, even if Gothmog as a commander is in the doghouse, that doesn't mean you're like, oh, for that reason, we're going to keep out, like, our most effective, right, like, piece of infantry out of this battle.
Seems to me like we got to kill somebody off. Because it's just, like you say, it's not logical for them not to be there.
The only thing we can do, the only thing I can think of that makes that holds water at all would be if they have some other job elsewhere. But what? Is he going to send...
I don't know what it would be.
Unless we have a job for, like, the whole crew of Balrogs back east in Hildorian. Right, he's come back. Morgoth has come back, right? But again, why would you do both? Why would you time your initiative for the time when you sent off your heavy infantry?
Right.
Like, it doesn't...
Exactly.
That's dumb.
That's right.
Yeah, it's just... And no matter how I slice it, I cannot think of a strategy that makes sense. Like, the first force, the primary force that's attacking Minas Tirith is the one that needs the muscle. Right, this is supposed to be the sledgehammer of this attack. So obviously, Marie says the fanning the volcano idea is looking better and better. Is there anybody we can spare? We could kill Angrod. Can't we spare Angrod? We could kill off both Ethelos and Angrod.
He says that so enthusiastically, doesn't he?
Well, they're all going to die eventually. Come on. I mean, look at the big picture. In the Silmarillion, it's not a question of keeping people
alive.
That's true.
It's that a would question be nice.
It's a question of deploying their deaths to the maximum effect.
It does seem like Angrod's the right choice, actually.
We are missing... excuse me. We are missing... You guys should be the ones yawning, not me. we are missing at least one tragic note for an otherwise, you know, like a glorious victory.
Yeah.
And
we don't want to kill off too many people.
Given Ethelos's situation, Angrod seems like a really good choice for that.
Angrod is slated for death in the Dagor Bragalach anyway, right? So he's going to die by the end of season 5 at the latest.
So we just move him up one.
Angrod and Ignor both die in the Dagor Bragalach, right? Why have both of them die in one battle in Dorthonion when we could get two battles worth of Noldor deaths for the price of one, right? Especially since the death of Ignor, because Ignor is the one that we need for the Athrabeth, right? Ignor rather is the one who's going to fall in love with Andreth, and we're going to have the tragic romance of tragic romances of season 5, right? So, the chief tragic romance of season 5. So his death in the Dagor, that's going to be the hard hitting emotional moment, right?
When
Ignor dies.
Yeah, we
can't. So Angrod is just going to look like a plus one at that point when Angrod also dies, right? And he's already done all of the things that he has to do, right? He's had his spat with Carinthir. He's had his moment with Thingol, right? There's no other jobs apart from his death in the Dagor Bragollach. He's out of jobs, right? Here, and he's
plus
a little bit
is dying too, right?
Who? What?
Ethelos is dying.
If Ethelos dies as well, right, we can have No, I'm liking this idea more and more, especially if Angrod and Ethelos both die in the battle. And I would be, you know, Rhiannon, if we want to do something to kind of redeem Ethelos or something, maybe? I don't know. Maybe we redeem her. Maybe she just dies tragically. Tony wants to know if Angrod is going to take a Balrog with him. Nah, I don't think so.
How about Angrod dies while having to put his own wife down? Or maybe she kills him.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, how we want to handle Ethelos's end. I think I would vote for something like, I don't know that we can redeem her because her will is dominated. Like Morgoth has the power to just own her, and he does. That's what the spell of Bottomless Dread does. She can't break it, but she could have like a period of lucidity where she confesses and, you know,
I mean, does she, you know how when Sauron gets vanquished in the Third Age and all of his minions suddenly kind of lose his presence.
Yes.
I mean, I'm thinking if there's something that causes Morgoth to shift his attention or you know what I mean, break so that she gets that moment of lucidity. I mean, I don't know if that's possible. I don't know if the Bottomless Dread
it's hard. And
works
it's true it's true that Morgoth isn't at the battle personally, as someone was just pointing out, but he doesn't have to be. Again, that's the point of the spell of Bottomless Dread, is that it follows you around no matter where you are. Like, that's like the textbook definition. It's like the literal book definition of the spell of Bottomless Dread, is that once you are placed under the spell of Bottomless Dread, you can't shake it, and it follows you for the rest of your life. Yeah.
Have we talked about how we're having Ethelos die? Because I would think she just would, commit suicide at some point.
It's possible. I'm kind of thinking
maybe in her moment of lucidity, she tells Angrod to, you know, you're going to have to kill me. And he's like, no, I don't want to do that. And then Morgoth takes over again, and then she pulls out a knife and advances on him, and he eventually has to kill her. But then in his despair at having just killed his own wife, then he just runs into the thick of battle.
I wouldn't want him to commit suicide, though. If he's going to die by Balrog, he should die fighting the Balrog. The other suggestion was that Ethelos...
I'm not saying suicide, but I'm saying sort of reckless despair.
Yeah, like Éomer.
He comes over all fey and charges off at the Balrog.
Like Fingolfin.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
This could be a foreshadowing for what happens with Fingolfin.
Yeah. Maybe. I'm not sure I want to go that far. But I'm not sure I like the opposite direction of having Ethelos in her moment of lucidity, attack or defend Angrod from the Balrog and die heroically defending her husband from the Balrog.
I hate to say this, but that's a little cheesy to me.
It is a
especially
little bit.
If we're going to kill him anyway, what's the point of saving
Morgoth,
his life?
I mean, first of all, can she even have this lucidity? Like you said, the spell follows her around. I mean, I don't even know that that lucidity is even possible. And the other thing somebody just mentioned is, I mean, Morgoth, there could come a point to where her utility is at an end and Morgoth just tells her to off herself. You know what I mean? So she just, like, under his influence, she just walks, like somebody said, walks into a Balrog or something.
I mean, sort of the logistics of it aside, I kind of crave like the brief moment of lucidity, just an opportunity to say goodbye, to crank up the tragedy.
Right.
But then I want her to have a tragic end too. No heroic death. No like you know.
I don't know that I want redemption. I'm not saying I don't think she should be redeemed, but I just
no redemption.
It doesn't seem right with the mechanics of the spell. It just doesn't seem like it would be.
There should be no
redemption.
It seems
like it would be too contrived. And even the farewell thing seems a little.
What about suicide? For Aetherlos.
I think the thing about Morgoth telling her, "Okay, now go kill yourself," would be.
No, I'm saying like she could have a moment of lucidity and kill herself.
And kill herself
in her moment of lucidity.
Yeah, I had thought about that. Yeah.
I'm fine with that too.
I could totally see that because she'd be basically at the brink of insanity. It, when she's lucid, she understands what's happening to her, and that would just make the despair would be.
I'm coming around, Dave, to your Fingolfin-esque rage fey moment for Angrod. Because remember, Angrod, he's been the anger management dude from the beginning, right? I mean, Angrod has had anger issues. And to show him having lost everything at the end, right? His wife, he's just, you know, found that his wife betrayed them. And then, you know, she commits suicide. And so even though he may, in that moment, realize that she didn't do it under her own power, still she's dead now and he's lost everything. And, you know, he's the guy who was already super angry after the kinslaying and then the abandonment by Feanor. So, you know, he's been, and then of course the conflict with Caranthir. So he has been like a cauldron of boiling anger from the very beginning of his character introduction. So to have him just like lose it, like, so, you know, Angrod just snaps and we can have him like carve his way. So it can be slightly Fingolfin-esque in the sense that he effectively like carves his way through the orcs on the battlefield, approaches a Balrog, duels the Balrog as a kind of little taste and anticipation of the duel with Morgoth, and then is crushed. I think that would... and then Marie points out that Ignor could break his sword while trying to come to his brother's aid. Sure. Yeah, we need Ignor to break his sword, so absolutely.
And Nick, I'm not sure... I mean, we're arguing against Aetherlos dying redeemed. So she dies unredeemed. There's no redemption.
Yeah, no, exactly. We're not worried about her being redeemed.
Right.
She would be, she's not like, we don't get hope from her. We have pity. She is an object of pity only. She is, and this happens a lot, of course, in the Silmarillion. She is an instance of the horrible works of Morgoth, right? Mm-hmm. And the terrible things that Morgoth does to people. So she is like, you know, like a little mini version of like the Turin story, right? In a different,
right.
Morwen. Yep. Okay, yeah, exactly, Brian. She doesn't overcome, she can't overcome the spell enough to work against Morgoth, but she might overcome it just enough to commit suicide. Yeah, exactly.
That makes sense to me, as opposed to like this complete moment of like complete clarity, but just enough to be able to off herself.
And let's face it, people in despair committing suicide, that's a Tolkienian thing, like through and through. That's a Tolkien, that happens on more than one occasion, right, in Tolkien's works. Yeah, I mean, that's really kind of in keeping. I mean, for her, I mean, she has like a little Nienor moment. Like she would be, you know, maybe we have her jump off something, like jump off the wall of Minas Tirith or something. Anticipation.
And, like, not on fire, like off the prow.
No, not on fire. No. Yeah.
That'd be way too obvious a foreshadow.
Yeah, no. The foreshadowing would be foreshadowing Nienor leaping into the...
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. No, that's good. And then Angrod.
No,
you know,
no Denethoring.
No Denethoring. Absolutely not. Rhiannon, and I don't think it will weaken the suicides of Turin, Nienor, and Maedhros later. First of all, because those are all very different circumstances. We're going to parallel Nienor with the plummeting to her death. But I mean, look, Rhiannon, on the one hand, I would say, how on earth could one weaken the suicide of Turin in Nienor? Like, that situation is its own deal, right? And it's not going to be undermined by the fact that somebody else committed suicide in despair in quite different circumstances later on, or earlier on. So,
who knows? You know, oh no, Nienor wouldn't have. I was going to say Nienor could have heard the story, but she wouldn't have, you know. Like,
yeah, no, she.
The story being told, she wouldn't have.
Yeah.
Never mind.
But anyway, yeah, no, I think that works really well. Okay, now last thing. So, by the way, we're totally not getting to episode 10 tonight. That's absolutely not happening. But we've done a lot of great work on the Dagor Aglareb. I'm happy with that. Just pointing out, I'm well past the point of trying to rush on to episode 10 now. But anyway, okay. Last thing, Doriath. What do we want to do? Clearly, Finrod is going to send a message, right? The orc army is bearing down on Minas Tirith. He's obviously going to send a message to Thingol, right? Help! Help! We're being destroyed, right? What happens? What? So Thingol is...
That's a brilliant question.
He's just... the reveal has just happened, right? He's still awful sore about the kinslaying business, right? Enough to just be like, I don't care, let Finrod get destroyed?
Like, tit for tat?
Yeah, I mean, but Finrod?
That seems weird to me, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I could see him not bestirring himself to go help the Feanorians.
Right.
But how do we have Thingol... How can we have Thingol deciding to do nothing without completely losing all sympathy for Thingol at all, like, without making him a villain from this point on, you know?
Brian Dimmock kind of, he's basically saying he could dither to the point where, I mean, one option, of course, would be that he could send soldiers up at wait far too late for anything.
Right, yeah. Right. Yes. Would Beleg and Mablung go? Yeah, and Tony says that Beleg and Mablung, they would surely argue for intervention, so right. Thingol would have to forbid them for going. I mean, that's the only reason they wouldn't go.
True.
Chris is suggesting maybe Athelwass intercepts the message to Thingol instead of the message to the Feanorians.
That's a good point. I mean, Nick is pointing to something like that Thingol's first thought would be, I must defend my own borders. I must strengthen my own borders. You know, right. He'd be concerned about his own land. But again, it's Finrod, so
it's a hard sell to just let Finrod die.
Yeah.
Unless he doesn't think that...
Tony suggests maybe it's Melian who advises against, but why would Melian advise against it?
Yeah, why would she do it? I mean, if Melian advises against it, that would imply that not going is good advice, right? I mean, if we go under the premise that Melian generally gives good advice...
That Thingol doesn't listen to.
Which Thingol doesn't listen to. To have her give him bad advice that he does listen to would seem to kind of queer the pitch for later on, right? When we want it to be clear that he should always listen to his wife, and so when he doesn't listen to his wife, it's bad, right?
I mean, the obvious thing would be that she's giving him the advice to go, and he doesn't take her advice. I mean,
right, and there we want to be careful not to overplay that hand,
make
right?
It a
to
thing.
Have him constantly ignoring his wife.
Right, right, right.
So Maria's suggesting a compromise Melian advises they send aid, but then he dithers and is too late to do so.
Now, does he go? I mean, do the soldiers start out? I mean, does he actually send them out and then the battle's over? And I don't know.
Yeah, have Mablung show up too late.
Right.
With a contingent.
Because Thingol took his own sweet time deciding.
And that... Ah, oh, okay. In episode 10, we're going to be dealing with Fingolfin's reaction to the ban, right?
Right.
If right. Fingolfin's reaction to the ban happens... So we have an awkward moment, right? The Dagor Aglora bends. Hooray! The good guys win. Then Thingol's army shows up and is like, came to help. guess we're a little bit late. Strong temptation from some of the Noldor, and I'm thinking some of the Feanorians would be quite open about saying, oh, well, right. Thanks for that. That was wonderful. You guys are exactly as useless as we always thought you were. Thanks right. for nothing. And you're this useless and you expect us to conform to your stupid ban,
right?
Right? I'll show you where you can put your ban, right? That would be one very logical response. So then Fingolfin basically goes against that tide. And
right.
instead reaches out and, meets with the forces of Thingol there and reconciles. So this would be the occasion which would then lead in episode 10 to the sort of the reconciliation thing. Yeah.
I kind of like that. I like that.
Give us an opportunity there.
It also deals with, I mean, to have Thingol not send anybody it just doesn't make sense to me, but to have him dither about it to the point where it's too, they get there too late. I think that makes more sense.
So, Nick, that what I was describing, the armies of Doriath arriving too late and the Noldorin reaction to that late arrival, that's an episode 10 thing. I'm not suggesting we do in episode 9. But
we do need a short scene.
We need to
in
set
this
it up.
Episode. Yeah, the setup would be here, but I don't think it needs to take a lot of screen time.
No, I think that we need to have, and maybe we can leave it with an open question. So getting back into Thingol's head for a second, I'm thinking what happens is he hears about the danger, right? And his first reaction, like Thingol's knee jerk, is let the Noldor stew, right? They've earned this.
Right.
The orcs can't get in here. We're safe in Doriath. We'll protect our borders. And if the orcs try to come this way, we'll kick them back out into play. But forget it. We're not sticking out our necks for the bloody kinslaying Noldor, right? that's his first reaction, right?
Right.
But then he thinks better of it. And we need to show him not just being browbeaten by Melian, who's like, now, dear, right, let's think this through a little bit more carefully.
Yeah.
We don't have to do it like that. Thingol, like, that's his first impulse, and we can be unclear as to whether or not he's going to change his mind, but then we can show, like, he did change his mind, right?
Melia doesn't really say anything. She'd just give him the side eye.
Right, exactly. So we can, in other words, what we show, the one scene we get in Doriath in episode 9 early on, I would think, in the episode, Finrod's messenger arriving, could be left ambiguous, right? We don't, like, it looks like Thingol isn't going to come. When then we don't go back to Doriath in the rest of the episode and his armies don't arrive, right? The battle's over and Thingol hasn't shown up. Then everybody from the Noldor, and including the audience, is left to assume the worst, right? That he just stayed home and left Finrod to die. Then at the beginning of episode 10, Mablung shows up, and then we're like, oh yeah, okay, it was kind of awkward, but Thingol decided to join in. Sorry, we missed the battle. So I think makes sense of thing. It works psychologically, in Thingol's current state of mind, right? But I think we could execute that, or at least I should say, I trust implicitly that our brilliant script designers can arrange that so that Thingol does not yet look like a completely unredeemable jerk at this point. So I think y'all can handle that. Okay. Good. I think that works. That's a pretty good episode for the Dagor Aglareb. I think this combines a whole bunch of things and works within our larger themes this season without being too forced. So
I think the previews for this are going to definitely make people watch it.
Oh man. Yeah.
You this know, is next be, time on this is the be an Silmarillion
exciting episode.
That's right.
Very
That's
right. exciting episode. Oh yeah. Like despairing suicides,
Balrog
slaying Noldor princes. Oh man.
Broken swords. Woo-hoo!
Broken swords. More swords will be broken. Named characters will be slain. Absolutely.
That's the key to making an epic TV
that's
hit
right.
these days.
Yeah. That's pretty much all the elements you need, right? There will be, you catastrophes and unexpected betrayals.
That's right. Yeah. Actually, and, the whole entire cast will get wiped out.
That's true.
That's later. That's a few seasons down the road. Yeah, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Oh, it's
that's
coming.
Marie says eventually, yes.
Eventually, exactly. Yeah. I forgot to mention, I think it was Marie mentioned earlier on, one of the other genius things about killing off Angrod and his wife and Aethelwulf both in this episode, Orodreth is an orphan now.
Right.
We just decided
right.
that Orodreth was definitely
oh, yeah.
going to be the son of Angrod, right? So now
I meant
Orodreth
to say that
because
I saw the same thing and I meant to say something like Orodreth is the orphan. Yeah, it's like, that's right.
Perfect. So that's why, of course, now this is why he's always hanging out with Uncle Finrod, right?
Right.
Because Finrod
right.
kind of takes him in now that both of his parents have been killed in one horrible, tragic day in this battle, right? So.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, and his father going down in a blaze of glory like this, again, so this also helps to contribute to, like, why Orodreth is kind of a milksop and tentative and not wanting to charge into battle later on,
right?
Right.
I
mean, this can work in a whole bunch of ways, so love it. Love this, that is an unexpected, I was not thinking of Orodreth at all, but that is, like, such a wonderful perk of killing off both of his parents in this episode that, like, it totally puts the stamp of approval on killing off Angrod. Like, that's absolutely the right thing to do here.
Now, did you tell everybody here tonight that we're going to be doing this again next week?
Okay, no, I haven't. So that is the last thing I'm going to say, and then we're going to go. We have to monkey with the schedule a little bit, as is often the case. We've got some conflicts coming up. So the next scheduled episode...
We have some... Is that the okay. royal we?
It's the royal we. Yes. The royal we. That is we and other people.
As in the Olsen family.
It's not the Olsen family, actually. This
oh,
is...
it's not.
We're accommodating some other... There's another broadcast that we're shifting... To accommodate and everything. This is the star-crossed episode of the Mythgard Movie Club, which has already been canceled twice. And so they were trying to go for the first, which was in between some film sessions, but then they're like, they couldn't do it and they could do the eighth. And I'm like, look, that's been canceled twice. We can shift some film. So anyway, so we're shifting to next week. So our next episode will be next week on Thursday, August 1st. And then our next episode after that will be, we'll be 3 weeks after that. So we'll be back to the regular schedule. So we'll be back to the 22nd of August. So the next session will be on August 1st and the session after that will be on the August 22nd.
But people that have subscribed will get a email right with the update on the schedule.
Yeah. I'll do that. Try to remember to do that this evening. So, I think we'll be discussing our final creative content session, our final digression session for season 4 next week, where we wanted to talk about dragons, of course, plus any other topics listeners wish to raise. Not sure if maybe we might, I don't know where we'll squeeze episode 10 in because we didn't get to it. But anyway, we'll sort that out. If you have other things that you want, we've discussed a bunch of odds and ends, the size of Thorondor, Mithros's prosthetic hand. You know, there are a bunch of really interesting questions and topics that you guys have raised on the discussion boards that we have addressed. We're going to talk about dragons and sort out dragons next time, which is great. We kind of pushed that back last time we talked about the bad guys. So we'll wrestle
with
the dragon question
the
next
end, right?
time. But yeah,
are we doing music at the very end?
Yeah,
we're going to
do that in post-production. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Philip, I've heard some of the work that you've been doing already on this. I'm really looking forward to talking about the music stuff with you when we get into the post-production episodes. But okay, so we'll do Dragons next time again. So please do go to the discussion boards if you have other questions or creative issues like we've been doing that you would like us to address. We'll see if maybe we can squeeze it into next week, August 1st, Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, which is our next episode. If not, we'll talk about it in the context, maybe a post-production. But anyway, we'll try to squeeze it in there. And then we'll come back and we'll do episode 10 and 11, I think, after on the 22nd. All right.
Perfect.
That's the plan. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. This was a really fun discussion. I love working out this kind of thing. This has been great. So thanks for joining us. And I will say, as always, thanks for listening and Godspeed.